KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Washington Gorge Action Program's Back to School fundraiser August 23rd from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Columbia Gorge Interpretive Center, 990 Rock Creek Drive in Stevenson, Washington. There will be a fashion show, live music, a silent auction, and dessert social. Washington Gorge Action Programs is a multi-purpose human service organization dedicated to helping individuals, families, and communities address basic human needs. Again, that's the Washington Gorge Action Program's Back to School fundraiser, August 23rd at the Columbia Gorge Interpretive Center, 990 Rock Creek Drive in Stevenson, Washington. More information about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River, on Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab, 6543 North Burlington in North Portland. This storytelling event will feature the Grand Ronde Tribe's history of the river, as well as drumming by tribal members. Raconteur Roger Wendlick will offer a description of Lewis and Clark's first impressions of the Lower Willamette, and Sean Morgan will describe experiences living aboard a sailboat at Willamette Cove. The Willamette River Superfund Community Advisory will be on hand to offer updates, information, and opportunities for community feedback. Again, that's The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River, Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. The time is 10:02 a.m. Air Cascadia is off today. Stay tuned for Flashpoints, followed by the incomparable Radio Zine, right here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, your community radio.
Today on Flashpoints, we feature an exclusive interview with Ira Kurzban, legal counsel for former Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who's facing allegations of embezzlement and corruption in his country. Then we have an in-depth conversation with Henri A. Giraud about his book, The Violence of Organized Forgetting, Thinking Beyond America's Disimagination Machine. Finally, as the world confronts the breakout of hostilities and war around the planet, executive producer Dennis Bernstein talks with radical Buddhists about the prospects for peace. I'm Kevin Pina, filling in for Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on your daily investigative news magazine, Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And now we turn our attention back to Haiti, where the U.S.-backed government of Michel Martelly continues its full-court press in allegations against former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. They recently tried to subpoena him. Then they issued an arrest warrant saying that he never responded to the subpoena. Now joining us is his legal counsel in the United States, Ira Kurzban. Ira, welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. Appreciate it.
Well, you know, we've gone over this lots. You know, we can track this all the way back to 1991 and Brian Littell before the U.S. Senate claiming that Aristide was crazy and on lithium and had been institutionalized in a Canadian mental institution, which was later soon to be false. We know that there have been this sort of revolving door of charges against former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. But I want to hear from you again. Our listeners need to hear it. They can't hear it enough about this campaign against former President Aristide.
Well, let me go back to 2000, not quite back to 1991, but 2000. That was the year there were elections held in Haiti, and President Aristide's party, Famille Lavalas, virtually won every seat in both the lower house and the Senate. I mean, they won over 70%. They had a clear controlling majority. And that was while President Preval was still president. The election was coming up and Aristide was running, and it was clear that Aristide was going to win. In fact, the United States government's own poll showed that 75% of the Haitian people supported the Famille Lavalas party and its platform. And that platform, of course, was to try and alleviate the harsh poverty that exists for the vast majority of people in Haiti, all of whom were anxious and willing to vote and obviously supported President Aristide when he first got elected in 1990 by 67% of the vote, and his popularity only increased after he eliminated the military in Haiti. So that by the year 2000, the Lavalas party was likely to remain in power for many, many years. The United States began, along with the French and the Canadians, basically to plot the destabilization of Haiti because they did not want the Lavalas party to stay in power for a long period of time. And so in the year 2000, under the Bush administration, the United States government withdrew all aid from the government of Haiti under a ridiculous pretext that seven of the senators, now remember President Aristide was not in power then, but seven of the Senate races were not counted properly. They were counted properly, but they brought in the OAS to make a claim that it wasn't. And the OAS, as you will see in our discussion, has been used repeatedly to fix elections in Haiti by having their observers come in and make certain claims, most of the time false claims. But in the year 2000, they made the claim that seven of these Senate seats were not properly counted. When President Aristide won the election several months later, the first thing that he did is get those seven senators, not all of whom, by the way, were members of Famille Lavalas. So he was only able to get, I think there were eight contested seats. He was able to get the seven in his own party to agree to resign and to have new elections. Notwithstanding that, the United States government, first under the Bush administration and then under the Clinton administration, continued what amounted to a destabilization program against the government of Haiti by withdrawing all aid from the government. Subsequent studies that were done indicated that not only was that aid withdrawn, but the money was given to various organizations to attempt to destabilize the government through media and through other methods, but to create the conditions that ultimately led in 2004 to the overthrow of President Aristide. And lo and behold, the people who were involved in the overthrow of the president were people who were either trained in counterintelligence by the United States in Ecuador, such as Guy Philippe, or worse, people like Jodelle Chamblain, who was the co-head of this group attempting to destabilize the government and bring about the coup. Chamblain was an asset of both the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency, and repeatedly so, and he kept appearing again and again in different places. In 1991, after the first coup, he was the co-head of the FRAP, which was a terrorist organization, reappears in 2004 as the head of the so-called Rebel Army, reappears again in 2010 when Duvalier comes back as his chief bodyguard, and was widely known as an asset of the Central Intelligence Agency and the DIA. And so basically in 2004, there is this coup against President Aristide. Immediately after the coup, sponsored by the United States, the French, and the Canadians, the United States government itself engages in a prolonged investigation against President Aristide. They spend millions and millions of U.S. taxpayers' dollars bringing an ATF investigation, an IRS investigation, a DEA investigation, all of which ultimately led to nothing because there really was nothing there. other than the U.S. disinformation campaign about how Aristeed was involved in drugs and had laundered money and so forth, all of it went to naught because there really was no claim against President Aristeed to begin with. It was really all part of a smear campaign. The reason why I give this background to your listeners is so that they'll understand the context in which this is occurring. Every time there's an election in Haiti, it would be funny if it wasn't so tragic, but every time there's an election in Haiti, there's a claim that President Aristeed somehow is involved in some misdeed. And the reason for it is simple. The United States government well knows that if President Aristeed were to run tomorrow for president, he'd win overwhelmingly. If the Lavalas party were allowed to run in Haiti, they would win overwhelmingly, because they represent the sentiments and actual interests of the vast majority of the Haitian people who were poor and disenfranchised. So it is no surprise, to come back to today, it is no surprise that while the U.S. government is, on the one hand, pushing to, quote, have elections in Haiti, on the other, using Martelly, whose election itself was actually fraudulently manipulated by moving him from third place to second place in a runoff, again with the help of the OAS. But it's no surprise that as we're approaching elections, all of a sudden, once again, in Haiti now, because nothing was ever sustained in the United States despite the millions of dollars that were spent, again, there are now new charges of corruption, of drug dealing, et cetera, against President Aristeed. So for those of us who have followed this for many, many years, we take what is happening in terms of any charges against President Aristeed within the political context in which it's occurred now for roughly about 15 years, which is that it's completely politically motivated. And I know obviously people say that all the time, but in this case there is clear evidence of it over the years, and the fact that there was a coup and the fact that Martelly's election was manipulated by the help of the United States, French and Canadian governments, that Martelly himself has always been identified with the Duvaliers and the right wing in Haiti, and that he knows he is there serving at the pleasure of the United States government, who helped him get elected, that it's no surprise that his own judge, and there's certainly a question about this judge who has been disbarred for the next 10 years by the Haitian Bar Association itself. So the judge who is conducting the so-called investigation, A, does not have the credentials to be a judge, and B, has actually been prevented from practicing law in Haiti by the Haitian Bar Association for the next 10 years because of his conduct and background. Given that this is the milieu in which these charges have now emanated, and no one who really knows the situation in Haiti takes them seriously.
Thank you. That is the voice of Ira Kurzban, who is the official legal counsel for former President Jean-Bertrand Aristeed. Ira, thanks for joining us today on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you.
And now we're going to take a music break. And when we get back, we're going to talk with Henry Giroux about his book, The Violence of Organized Forgetting. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And now it's my great honor to interview our next guest. It is Henry A. Giroux. He wrote a recent book, a new book that's entitled The Violence of Organized Forgetting. He's currently the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest at McMaster University in Canada. Welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, sir.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Kevin.
Henry, what an amazing book. You and I were just discussing the difference where you are now in Canada and how you could never probably have at a university here in the United States a chair for scholarship in the public interest. And one of the things that we had struck upon here was, of course, there's a different history. The United States had the history of the fear of anarchism first and then the fear of communism and McCarthyism, and that really altered the trajectory of the United States.
It actually introduced a culture of fear and the pathologizing of dissent long before 9/11. And I think that many people are unaware of that. I mean, they're unaware of the fact that if you go back to the 1980s, which is really where a lot of this stuff actually comes into fruition outside of the McCarthy era, you go back to Ronald Reagan attacking Angela Davis in the universities, to say the least, claiming that they were harboring a radical communist. And then you move to the East Coast and you get John Silber in Boston University, who claimed he was a liberal but did the same thing, absolutely prided himself on purging Boston University, as he said, of anyone who took up African-American history from a radical perspective, multiculturalists, Frankfurt School theorists, radical educators, and of course I was one of his victims. But if you then move to 9/11, you get the argument by then Darth Vader's wife, Lynn Cheney, that the universities are basically the last residue to hold off in the struggle against terrorism. So you have a long tradition in which domination becomes synonymous with not just simply the squelching of dissent, but with an attack on reason itself, which you now see in the most fundamental radical fringe of the Republican Party.
Well, it's interesting because you'd also said that, you know, and I think you point this out in your book, that there is this trend since became more immediate during Ronald Reagan or more accentuated of anti-intellectualism.
Yes, yes. Oh, it's an enormously powerful force in the United States. I mean, a lot of people don't remember, but in 1971, there was something called the Powell Memo. And the eventual Justice of the Supreme Court, Judge Powell, who was working for the Chamber of Commerce, and they were really concerned about what had happened in the 60s. They thought the universities were really off track, harboring radicals, attacking free enterprises, and it goes on and on. And so they developed a plan, and the plan was they had to make education central to basically conservative politics. And so they began to take culture very seriously. And they called for waging attacks on the liberal university. They called for creating their own conservative foundations, their own newspapers, their own anti-public intellectuals. And I think from the 1980s until, of course, 2014, we have really seen the impact of that.